Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Grimm. Welcome to Deconstructed. If you're ever making a list of the top 10 best Karl Marx riffs, one that's always going to make it on there comes from the 18th Brumaire of Napoleon Bonaparte when he said, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living." It's an important concept to remember, and one that Kamala Harris riffed on recently when she mused, "You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you." Now, Kamala's father was a Marxist professor from Jamaica, so perhaps he passed down to her his spin on that old idea. But either way, it's a concept I've been reflecting on as I think about the crisis in Cuba today. Protests have broken out recently as an economic catastrophe has gripped the island, with the Cuban people being slapped around by the dead hand of the Cold War. On today's show, to walk us through how we got to this point and who today is doing the slapping, we're joined from Havana by Andres Pertera, who's a fifth-year PhD candidate in Latin American Caribbean history at the University of Madison. Andres, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
So just for fun for the audience, I don't know about fun. Actually, let's talk a little bit about how tricky it was to get on here. What's it like on a day-to-day basis engaging with people who are over here on the mainland in the U.S. through the embargo? What kind of obstacles does it throw up that you might not even think of?
A lot of apps are blocked. And then, you know, of course, the Cuban government blocks things online. But a lot of these things are blocked because they're trying to avoid OFAC sanctions, so Treasury Department sanctions. So I can't download a lot of apps. I have to already have the apps on my iPhone. I can't just use the nifty new eSIM that I have only iPhone, because eSIM doesn't work in Cuba and carriers from the U.S. don't really want to work with Cuba in a normal way. It's expensive to do phone calls. I can't get into my university accounts online because there's a two-factor authentication system. And that app is apparently blocked in Cuba, as is another of the apps we tried to record on.
And that's one of the things that people don't really understand about sanctions, is that the Treasury Department will sometimes say that these are narrowly targeted sanctions and, you know, they're aimed only at this particular thing. But the penalty for getting hit with them is so extreme that companies around the world are like, if we can even see the sanctions from where we are, we're just going to get out of Dodge. And so, yeah, you can't use the app, can't use this, can't use your two-factor authentication, can't get into your university email account from Cuba. What are you doing your dissertation on specifically?
In broad strokes, I'm doing a dissertation on Cuba after 1991. And there's historians who have done really great work on Cold War Cuba, but there's not a ton on post-1991 by historians because it's seen as too recent. And that's kind of let the space kind of get flooded with cranks of one inclination or another. And so I'm trying to do a more serious study of Cuba after 1991 and how the system kind of survives losing 70% of its foreign trade, like all this aid and credit, all of this overnight, losing that because the USSR fell, and somehow reconsolidating and in the 2000s into a very poor, very anemic, but still stable system, which is not at all what people predicted in the depths of the crisis of 1993 and 1994.
There was a phrase I remember that Cubans used to describe that period that was very evocative, that kind of trough right after the Soviet Union collapse. What did they call that era?
Special period in times of peace. Just special period for short is how they often call it. And it's to refer to wartime shortages in times of peace. That's why it's the special period.
And so let's start there. So what economic reforms did Castro implement in the 90s to bear the brunt of this absolutely unimaginable shock? You know, you've got this superpower that's basically subsidizing you, and then overnight it's gone.
Yeah, and I want listeners to understand, like, it's not just that Soviet subsidies were just, like, in the form of military aid or general economic aid. Cuba was sucking up about a third of all Soviet aid per annum in the 1980s. It was massive. It was pissing off even the Soviets. They were like, look at Cuba, it's taking up so much aid. And then they were also selling the oil for super cheap to the Cubans and then buying sugar way above market price from the Cubans. So it was a lot of subsidies, billions and billions of dollars. And overnight, it loses that. But it's worse than that because Cuba, because it was integrated into the socialist economic organization, the CAME, C-A-M-E, they were insulated from the embargo. And now not only do they lose subsidies in the 90s, but the embargo is there as ferocious as ever. And they even tighten it in the 1990s to make it even more aggressive in the hopes that kind of an accelerationist logic that hopefully that makes the government fall. The 90s were absolutely brutal. People who had been fat all of their lives become rail thin. Even if you had money, there wasn't necessarily anything for you to buy with it. People were going temporarily blind from vitamin deficiency. Like, the infrastructure was absolutely falling apart. If you ask any Cuban for, you know, their horror stories about that period, every single person has their own personal hell from that era. And the response of the state was to do a couple of things. Even though they had the clear counterexamples of Vietnam and China, which had already begun serious market reforms, moving away from the Soviet model and working towards a kind of compromise with a socialism in politics, but quasi-capitalism or full capitalism in the economy, Fidel does not permit that at all. But he does open the door to a kind of hyper-state capitalism, as it were. Tourism is what they turn to. Because at this point, it's not just that the Soviets aren't buying sugar at subsidized prices. Sugar is no longer a luxury commodity like in the 19th century. Sugar is dirt cheap. The only way you can really make money is value-added alcohol or something. So they shift to tourism hard, which is ironically already what Cuba was doing in the 1950s before the revolution. But they move to tourism hard and they start building all these hotels, many private-public partnerships with Spanish hotel chains. And that's leads me to another big leap, which is in addition to trying to capture as much tourism currency as they can, though mostly not American because Americans can't legally come, they also begin to reach out to diversify their economy. The lesson of the 1990s was we cannot bet on one patron. We got to really diversify, and they start reaching out to all these different European countries, African countries, Latin American countries. Anybody who will do business with them, they'll do business with them, except maybe, I think, Israel and South Korea, and maybe Taiwan, like with maybe like carve outs, it really starts to diversify its economy. The key thing is that in agriculture, there's a partial dismantling of the state collectivization of agriculture that has never worked in any of these socialist countries, but there's not a full like shift to markets like in Vietnam and China. And that's a big mistake, and it's a big problem that they're kind of like still trying to deal with today. Fidel doesn't allow capitalist reform in the countryside, but he does allow kind of like state capitalism and people to allow to rent out rooms in their houses or open small cafeterias and restaurants in Havana as a way to try and capture as much tourism capital as they can. You also have, in the last couple of decades, the rise, it was already like happening here, but it's continued since, the use of doctors abroad. So Cuba will kind of loan out its doctors to other countries who will pay money to the doctors, but also to the Cuban state. And it mostly goes to the Cuban state, and then the Cuban state then uses that money to reinvest and all the rest. So it really tries to shift away from agro-export because sugar is a dead end. And that's why Fidel ends up dismantling most of the sugar sector by 2005. Cuba actually imports sugar now, which is the crazy thing. Yeah. So it's a big shift to tourism. So think of it as like the 90s in short term, in a few words, is shifted to services. That's basically Cuba's business model now.
How much does Venezuela help in the 2000s, you know, with the rise of Hugo Chavez and selling subsidized oil to Cuba and the kind of pink tide of the 2000s, did that give Cuba a boost? Did they sort of hang on long enough to like get a little lift there, or were they already kind of making the corner?
Both. So Cuba was already starting a very anemic recovery. It hits bottom, I think 93 or 94 is like the absolute worst moment of the special period. But by the late 90s, it was starting to recover. Still lots of scarcity, still lots of problems, but it's kind of okay. And Fidel lucks out that Chavez, who he had invited to Cuba after his Chavez's failed 1993 coup, 1992 coup, he invites him to Havana and kind of mentors him. And Chavez wins the election in 98 and starts sending an absolute ungodly amount of subsidies to Cuba. Not as much as the Soviet Union, admittedly. It's not that good of a patron, but it still was an absolutely, not disgusting, but just outrageous amount of subsidies, direct and indirect, which helps the Cuban economy kind of get out of the worst period. And by the tail end of Fidel's tenure, there was enough to do more harebrained schemes like classic Fidel. Like he bought in order, because old refrigerators use a lot of electricity. Fidel's solution was to buy every family in the country a new refrigerator, which they were supposed to pay back, and they never did. No one kept track and blah, blah, blah. But then, of course, the newer refrigerators were kind of cheap, and they kind of broke down. And so a lot of people then returned to the old refrigerators if they still had them. But instead of investing that in agriculture, right, which is extremely decapitalized, that's one of Cuba's big problems. It's gone back to oxen in agriculture. And so you have very low ag productivity per person, and it's a big reason why things are so expensive here, because the food is outrageous by like Cuban income standards.
And so how did the great financial crisis 2007, 8, 9 impact Cuba?
So I was actually here for that. I was an undergrad. I arrived right before that. Actually, before the economic crisis, Cuba got hit by three hurricanes, one in the east, one in the center, and one in the west, because it's hurricane season in the fall. And then the economic crisis happens. So it was really bad. Cuba had just imported a fleet of Yutong brand buses from China. But then because of the financial crisis, they didn't have the money to keep doing payments. And so the buses started to break down because they were being used so heavily and it's so hot here. And the Chinese wouldn't send replacement parts because the Cubans were behind on payments on the principal. It was really hard going that first like 2 years, just shortages of everything. Infrastructure was breaking down again. And then it starts to recover. And in no small part, thanks to the fact that this is also the period when Raul comes into power, 2000. Fidel gets sick in 2006, but only passes power formally to Raul in 2008. And so from 2008 to 2013, that period when I was an undergrad, those first 5 years are when Raul really starts to engage in more market-oriented reforms, especially in the cities, which help the economy kind of come back to life after a long period of barely getting by.
And so the U.S. hope with these strangulation sanctions after the Soviet Union fell, like you said, was they were going to heighten the contradictions and immiserate the population so savagely that they would rise up and, you know, demand freedom and liberty and democracy and overthrow the government. So what was the protest movement like throughout the 90s and 2000s? What did the U.S. achieve in kind of generating? And it's not just the U.S. driving it. Like when people are miserable, oftentimes they're moved to protest those conditions.
Right. I should stress that the embargo is explicitly about making people hungry and making them go into the streets. This is like declassified State Department stuff. Like that's not a bug. That's a feature of what the embargo is supposed to do. And it's been supposed to do for a long time. Since the 1990s, the problem has actually been that even most of the State Department has come around to the idea that it's a bad policy, because it just kind of gives the Cuban government fodder for blaming everything on the embargo. And the real reason that it's kind of still in play is that it's not a national security priority, because the Soviet Union's gone and there's no nukes in Cuba. So a small national lobby in a very strategic state that is Florida, the Cuban Americans, can basically have veto power over reforms on Cuba policy. Like that's kind of why it stays in place. But yeah, I mean, it is still meant to harm. The cruelty is the point. And what happens in the 1990s and the 2000s with protests is, I mean, I'm sure there are more than the one famous one, right? Which is 1994, August of 1994, which is called the Maleconazo, which is a name that derives from like the fact that it was along the Malecon, which is the seawall around Havana. In central Havana, which is a very working class neighborhood, people live cheek to jowl there. They were exhausted by the constant blackouts and shortages, and they take to the streets and they make political demands and material demands. And they're just like, yeah, we want change. And that was successfully diffused because it was a very spontaneous movement. There was no Twitter, no Facebook to kind of spread the news about what was happening or why. There was no leaders, no like list of demands specifically. And so when Fidel Castro leads a counter march, people aren't really sure what to do. And he's able to kind of, his gamble of leading a counter march in person is able to kind of diffuse things along with, of course, police action. But it's those two things in combination are able to kind of neutralize it and avoid a more Tiananmen style response from China, which I think no country, even like Cuba, wants to do. So that's kind of what happens with the 1994 protests. And it becomes the exception rather than the rule. A lot of people at the time thought it would be like the beginning of something, but it kind of dies on the vine. Part of that is also just technological. The state still has a monopoly on radio, television. You can't protest, you can't organize. You know, it's hard to build consensus in that context, right? There is kind of an incipient civil society movement with varying ties and sympathies to the US oftentimes, not solely, but oftentimes, partly because they can't really make a living if they are anti-government activists and almost all the jobs are with the state, right? So, you know, they need foreign funding, and then that opens them up to accusations of being foreign agents, and some of them are, but it's kind of a catch-22 for them. And it starts to gain traction by the late 1990s and early 2000s, but then it's kind of broken by 2003, which is called in opposition circles the Primavera Negra, which is when I think it's 75 activists were mass arrested. There's actually a really kind of funny anecdote in Richard Gott's book. He's a journalist who writes about Cuba, and he wrote a book about Cuban history, and he says in early on that when journalists went to the press event for the arrests in 2003, many of them were shocked because they found out that the opposition activists that they'd been talking to a week before turned out to be double agents for state security, like in high up places.
Oh, wow.
So it was it was kind of amusing in that sense, just how many people and how many opposition leaders ended up being state security aid plants. There's a movement that's born of the 2003 arrests, which is the Damas de Blanco, which means ladies in white. And it's a Catholic-centered movement of women family members of those who were arrested in 2003. And they do marches and things like that. And there was a lot of sympathy for them, especially with the state responses to them to try and suppress them. But at the same time, they never really become kind of a mass popular symbol in the way that I think the opposition wanted them to. There were other attempts as well to organize like a constitutional reform to pluralize the society. That's the Varela Amendment that they wanted to do, but that is stymied in committee, and then they added something else to the Constitution to prevent that exact strategy from happening again in the future. So it basically stagnates.
My guess would be that it also had something to do with Raul's economic reforms, you know, his opening up, his adopting a little bit more of the Vietnamese or Chinese model, you know, working and people seeing some improvement. Is that right? Were they not working as in the sense that like all of a sudden everybody's wealthy, but if your life is improving, you know, month to month, year to year, that might drain some of the energy. Just the same way that the State Department thinks that making people starve will bring them into the streets, you know, feeding them presumably keeps them off the streets.
I would say so. The Cuba that I lived during undergrad, 2008 to 2013, you had a block of people who were very strongly in support, a block of people who were very strongly against, and then a huge swath of the population, maybe even the majority at that point, who were not politically neutral, but just like, dude, let me live my life, take care of my children, take care of my parents, you know, go out with my girlfriend occasionally, just don't bother me. And the reforms really do help that, you know, a lot of people just kind of make peace with the system for a time. The way I kind of describe it to people is Raul Castro and then Díaz-Canel's kind of bargain was, if you leave politics to us, we will make slow but steady economic reforms that will improve your lives. A friend of mine actually mentioned once seeing a sign in Havana that said socialism and prosperity, which is a very different kind of slogan, but it kind of gives you an idea of that idea of things are going to get better. Just trust us. Give us time. We're moving in the right direction. And then, of course, the last few years, the crisis, partly pandemic, partly sanctions, partly just all these different factors, has kind of nuked that bargain for the time being. And I think that's where the crisis is coming from.
Socialism and prosperity sounds very Chinese. You can imagine seeing it there. So I'm curious, did China warm up to Cuba over this time period? As are they seeing Cuba kind of adopt some of their kind of socialism and prosperity ideology and being impressed and saying, you know, let us help out? Or no, that's too much trouble for them because they're over here, you know, they don't want to anger the angry tiger in the United States? Or what was and is the relationship between China and Cuba in that decade and a half?
I can give my appreciation as someone who does not study China, Cuba specifically, but from everything that I've seen, China's relationship is much more transactional than the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union, the reason that they gave Cuba so much subsidies was that they were in a inter-power competition with China, Maoist China in particular, for the emerging third world and the decolonizing world. And Cuba was such an important symbol to the third world that having that feather in their cap was important for Soviet prestige abroad. That's not true of the Chinese. Cuba is still a symbol, but China doesn't need that symbol in the same way that the USSR did. This calculus may change, especially one hypothetical scenario that I've given people is, for example, if things really heat up over Taiwan, I could see Cuba being used as kind of leverage to the more you push us on Taiwan, the more we'll like get into Cuba. But as a rule, you know, they've sent aid, they've sent credits, they've forgiven certain things. It's not that it's 100% transactional, but it's not as obviously just huge tubes of money to Cuba in the same way that the Soviets did. And we can see that the Chinese-Cuban relationship is strengthening by the fact that last year, or it might have been just early this year, but I think it was last year, Cuba signed on to Belt and Road. So it is integrating into the Chinese sphere, and it's aligned with China in many ways, but it's so far, it has no signs of being like the new patron in the way that the USSR was, and Venezuela was a kind of poor imitation of. China does not seem, as of yet, interested in playing that role.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. With Mint Mobile, you save money and get quality service. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/deconstructed. That's mintmobile.com/deconstructed. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/deconstructed. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So everything that I've heard about the situation in Cuba now is that it's just getting bleaker and bleaker. What are things like now, and why are we seeing this rapid kind of unraveling?
Part of it is that tourism hasn't come back. One of the gambles that the Cuban government made was, even in the middle of this crisis, we're going to keep building hotels because once the pandemic is over, we are going to be in serious need of foreign currencies. Cuban peso is play money, basically, on the international, you know, currency markets. We want hard currency. We want the dollar, the euro, right? We need it bad, and we're going to build these hotels with an eye to that. Tourism to Cuba has not recovered, so Cuba is short hard currency. Venezuela is another part of this equation. Venezuela, as I'm sure your listeners know, had a very profound economic crisis of its own in the 2010s. Because they thought that high oil prices were going to reign forever, and they mismanaged the oil sector. And it's not just a question of oil prices, but they mismanaged the oil sector so bad that they are still recovering production capacity for their oil sector. So there's less for them. And of course, there's less to send to Cuba, because the trade was they sent it to Cuba at very subsidized prices. Cuba uses it for its own needs and then refines it and re-exports it for cash, right? That was part of the way that Venezuela subsidized Cuba. But that, you know, with especially in the last couple of years, has been greatly diminished, and Venezuela's had issues keeping up its part of the bargain. The U.S. has tightened sanctions. Trump went full, like, maximum pressure sanctions, not just in terms of putting Cuba back on the international list of, like, state sponsors of terrorism, which was an entirely, nakedly, disgustingly clear case of politics. They did it right before they left office as a way to impede the Democrats from being able to, like, return to kind of a, like, an Obama era policy. It was like a very, like, you know, finger in their eye kind of thing. It was politics. But it's also the fact that Trump had activated Title III of Helms-Burton. And Helms-Burton is this law that was passed in the 1990s that really strengthened the embargo and gave the U.S. government the capacity to really go after foreign companies that trade with Cuba but also trade with the U.S. and sanction them. And among other things, it had a section which is called Title III, which had never until Trump been activated, even under Bush with Bolton there, you know, the most hawkiest guy you can imagine, even they never activated Title III. Title III allows U.S. citizens to sue people who trade or benefit from their assets that were nationalized in Cuba. So, for example, if you have a cruise ship and it docks in the port and the heir to that dock is still alive and he's a U.S. citizen, guess what? You're about to get a lawsuit in the millions and millions of dollars by a very litigious, very angry, and very well-funded Cuban-American with the full backing of the U.S. government behind him if he wins.
Some of these judgments have reached into the billions of dollars, and they're seizing Cuban assets all over the world. What's been the economic impact of that?
Well, I mean, there's no more cruise ships, among other things. When I left Cuba in 2013, cruise ships hadn't become big yet. When I visited again in 2018, I knew multiple people who were making a living off of very short-term, like, cruise ship tourism. The Americans or the Italians or whatever would be let out at the port. And every day there was a new ship. And they wouldn't spend a ton of money individually, but collectively, a lot of people were able to work the tourism trade by serving as guides, whatever. And then, of course, they took that money and then they consumed and they made jobs for other people. So that was a huge influx of cash for the country. And cruise ships are dead. The hotels, you know, at night, you'll see one or two rooms in use, but they're mostly empty in what's supposed to be part of the high season. It's been devastating. And because that's a source of key foreign currency, and Cuba imports 60 to 80% of all of the food it consumes, that's bad.
And so the Trump administration did this maliciously on the way out, trying to reverse the Obama administration's policy. And I've done some reporting on this particular piece. The Biden administration indicated to Democrats in Congress that they were reviewing whether, you know, Cuba actually belonged on this state sponsor of terror list that the Trump administration had put them on right before they left. Not that long ago, in a private meeting, the State Department informed some members of Congress, oh, actually, that review hasn't even started.
Oh, Jesus.
Which just absolutely shocked everybody in the room, because once it starts, then other things kick in. You know, statutorily, it has to take 6 months, and you got to do this, that, and the other thing. So by saying that it hadn't even started, the Democrats were just reeling, having heard that. I asked the State Department about that, and they more or less confirmed it in their answer without confirming it. But do you have any sense of, like, why Biden would continue this malicious policy, given the impossibility of him winning Florida? He'll be lucky to come within 10 points in Florida. So it's hard to say that the Miami Cubans down there are so central to his political strategy that he has to just drive this country into the ground for them. Like, what is your sense as the kind of Cuba watcher of why Biden just has refused to buck Trump on this? Just jealousy of Obama or something?
I don't think that anyone has a clear-cut answer just yet. I can give my theory, but I do think this is a case where we need a Bob Woodward-style deep dive into, like, the deep politics of it, because I'm sure it's a very complicated story. But my big theories on this are, number one, the curse of Cuba since 1991. It doesn't matter enough. It doesn't matter enough for Biden to use his precious political capital, time, and energy, and also potentially risk turning Florida even more red to do it. I don't think he cares enough is like number one. He's got domestic and foreign issues that are far higher on his list. And that's not unique to Biden. It's something that has kind of plagued Cuba since 1991. Because like I said to your listeners, after 1991, Cuba gets off the front burner, gets on the back burner. And that's why Florida has such a lock on it, because not enough people care to reverse the policy, even if most people, even in the State Department, know that as a policy, it doesn't make much sense. Number two, it was only a few months into Biden being in office when July 11th happened, the protests, the massive protests and the state response to them, and that made Cuba radioactive for a while. Because if he starts to do a reform in the middle of that context, he could be seen as being soft on communism or whatever. And so it looks bad, and Cuba was already not a priority, so they just put it into not even a priority, but even lower on the list. I think that that's kind of started to change. Sometimes there's been movements here and there to kind of slowly bring back some stuff from the Obama era, but I think it's been much more transactional. I think part of it is the fact that Cuba has had allowed a large number of people to migrate through Nicaragua to the U.S. via Mexico, to the point that the traditional triangle of immigrants, which is Mexico and Central America or whatever, were displaced at one point. I'm not sure if it's still true, but were displaced at one point by Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. So immigration has kind of pulled Biden back to the table. And that was, I think, part of the intent of that strategy on the part of the Cuban government. It's like, and it's an older strategy. We will collaborate with you on immigration, on drug stuff, on this and that and another thing, as long as you're reasonable with us. And if you guys aren't reasonable with us, we have no reason to help you out on your priorities either, right? This brings me to point three, which is I don't think Biden sees this as part of his legacy. He sees it, seems to treat it as that's Obama's legacy, right? You know, and it's kind of come to become a problem. So he's trying to kind of distance himself from it and be very transactional. But I don't think he sees it either as a priority or as something he really needs to or wants to burn political capital on, since it can be reversed again in the future. And, you know, it becomes a cycle of, you know, like two different people sharing a wheel, and they drive right and they drive left and nothing gets done. So it's kind of back to the back burner, I guess.
So we set up all of the conditions. What triggered this recent round of protests?
The most recent protests, I've seen videos. I don't think we're still getting like a clear picture of it because it's still a developing story. Broke out in the eastern provinces, in particular in Santiago, which is the second biggest city in Cuba. Bayamo, which is a smaller city, but it's also very symbolically important. It's part, the national anthem is called La Bayamesa, the woman from Bayamo. And El Cobre, which is also very symbolically important because of the La Virgen del Cobre. It's like kind of like the La Virgen de Guadalupe, the Virgin of Guadalupe, but for Cuba, La Virgen del Cobre. So there's one really big city plus two very symbolic cities, and they had these protests. People were complaining about corriente y comida, which means electricity and food. And you also had political slogans like libertad, which means freedom. You also had other political slogans there. So it's, again, a mix of material problems, right? Electricity, food. We're in the middle of a major inflationary crisis here. And that's combined with politics and political discontent. And the government's response to that has been to basically say, like, we know things are really bad right now. We're not, you know, we're not blind. We understand things are bad. But the government's position is that the anger is misplaced and that it should be fundamentally put on the shoulders of the U.S. due to the fact that even as bad as things are in Cuba right now and have been, the U.S. is still maintaining a pretty, like, if not maximum pressure, really high pressure sanctions strategy against Cuba. I think that the embargo is completely wrongheaded. I don't think it's justifiable either morally or practically. It's a mess. And sanctions against Russia for invading Ukraine makes sense because it's a war of aggression. Russians are going to get hurt by the sanctions, but, you know, Ukrainians are important too, right? You can justify it. But Cuba's not invading anybody, right? Like, I don't, and all the sanctions do is they make the government kind of like hold up and kind of get down into the trenches and fortify themselves because they feel like this northern superpower is trying to overthrow them and impose a puppet regime. And so as a nationalist government, first and foremost, they cannot allow what they see as foreign intervention in Cuban affairs. So, like, it's counterproductive, and on top of just being flatly unethical because of the fact that the burden is almost exclusively being felt by everyday Cubans who are just trying to live their lives.
And no government is perfect, I'm sure. You know, the current Cuban government could make some different decisions, but how much room do they have? Like, what could they do, you think, differently within the context of these, you know, lawsuits by Americans around the world, the state sponsor of terror designation, the Treasury sanctions, the embargo? What policy room for maneuver do they have that they're not using?
There are very clear reforms that they could do here that I think that would make life better. One of them is they really just need to give up on the ag bottle, the agricultural model that they've been using for years. It doesn't work. They really have to shift to something like the Vietnamese or Chinese models, or, you know, adapt it to Cuban conditions, but do it. Because, and they've been doing experiments for years on a more like market-oriented economy, and don't just have this system where you have to produce so much and everything above this quota can sell for the market, but everything under this quota you have to sell to us at a price we determine. Like, that model just does not work flat out. And you've got to liberalize the agriculture. You've got to shift to a small farmer model where people own the land again and then can reinvest in it and then can import directly, not having to depend on the state and its institutions, fuel, tractors, inputs, that kind of thing that they can potentially also export and get hard currency for that. I think that that would be a huge help because Cuba is an extremely agriculturally rich island. 70% of it is arable, 90% of it in a pinch. Like, that is an insane surface area to arable ratio. And there is no good reason why Cuba needs to be importing 60 to 80% of its food, especially when it doesn't even export sugar anymore. Now, with all that said, I think that's like a clear example of a domestic reform that they need to do. But on the other end, part of the problem, I think, is there's a lot of reforms that would have been extremely delicate and extremely difficult, even under the best circumstances, and political reforms, and they were put off, and they were put off, and they were put off. And now to do them under these circumstances might be seen as a repeat of what happened in the USSR, right? What is the lesson a lot of these socialist countries drew from Gorbachev? Gorbachev's reformed the economy and politics at the same time. He also mismanaged the economic reforms. People were very miserable. They were discontented, blah, blah, blah. But if you first reform the economy, maybe then you can reform the political system with people who are, by and large, if not in love with the system, at the very least, they're like, I can work with this. I don't want change because, you know, change can be scary. You know, this is the devil I know, whatever, right? But now, how do you do those kind of really deep political reforms or seeming potentially dangerous economic reforms in ways that, like, don't just fuel the fire? That is, I think, the kind of the catch-22 that they're in right now.
And the Soviet leadership also thought that if they kind of surrendered in the Cold War and did these reforms that the West wanted, that the West would embrace them and lavish, like, a new Marshall Plan, basically, on the post-Soviet world, which was just a fundamental misreading of the West's posture toward Russia. Like, we were not going to suddenly turn them into friends. It was much more intractable. You know, they believed that it was ideological, and it was obviously partly ideological, but it was also just, you know, geopolitical and, you know, imperial. And so I would imagine that the Cuban leadership understands the same thing, that just giving up is going to lead to probably the same looting that you saw, you know, post-Soviet collapse.
And when they talk to people, like Elian Gonzalez said, Cuba won't become like a Costa Rica or something. It'll become a Haiti. Like, that is what... I'm not saying he's right or wrong. I'm just saying this is kind of...
Elian Gonzalez? The Elian Gonzalez?
The Elian Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah. About that.
He was at my house before he left.
No way.
In the U.S. Yeah, yeah. My dad helped work on his case. Yeah, Elian Gonzalez made that comparison. I've also seen people say we're going to be like the DR or something, like, and there's going to be a lot of violence and instability in addition to the Americans are going to come, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of like the government's mindset. And one thing that I've told people as like an analogy for this is maximum pressure, U.S. Sanctions and like just political pressure, economic pressure are kind of like a Chinese finger trap with Cuba. By trying to tear the government apart, it actually consolidates the government's argument that they are besieged. And because they are besieged, they cannot allow the kind of liberalization, be it political or economic, that many people, even within the government, would like to see, right? And so it's actually counterproductive, but, you know, because you have this very staunch lobby, especially in Florida, the cruelty is the point. Like, it's to make everyday people hurt, because it's not that, like, especially with the older exiles who didn't live their whole lives under Fidel and just happened to come in the last few years. Like, for these people, they don't just hate the government. Many of them have a lot of frustration and anger at everyday Cubans because they're like, you guys are traitors because you guys let Fidel into power. You kept him in power. You supported him. And then things got bad. And now you turn to us. Like, screw you. And so it is emotional. It isn't like realpolitik. This is in many ways a revanchist policy.
Right. They're going to make them pay.
Exactly.
Well, this has all been very depressing, but I very much appreciate you joining me anyway. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. Anytime.
Deconstructed is a production of The Intercept. This episode was produced by Laura Flynn. The show is mixed by William Stanton. Legal review by Sean Musgrave and Elizabeth Sanchez. Leonardo Fireman transcribed this episode. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. And please go and leave us a rating or review. It helps people find the show. If you want to give us additional feedback, email us at podcast@theintercept.com and put deconstructed in the subject line. Otherwise, I might miss your message. And Andres, what's your Twitter handle? Because that's where I see a lot of your work, and I've found you to be a really great one to follow on that terrible platform.
Thanks so much. No, it's at A.S. Peritera. P as in Peter, E-R, T as in Tom, I-E-R-R-A. I'm also only one of only two Andres Peritieras on Twitter, so you should find me that way as well.
And the one who's often giving good book recommendations, that's the right Andres.
Thanks.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.